Okay. All right, so this morning, we did some, theory, legal studying, more law school 101, talking about a contract and everything else. And we'll learn about torts, I believe, is next week. So I wanted to do a quick kind of, shift, so we're not just completely, ooh, this is a contract and the very basics and everything else. So I want to talk, this is a little bit more kind of practical, although there are some legal things that I want you to learn in this as well. But we're going to talk about licensing of architects. When you guys get out eventually to practice architecture, and the word practice is a very important element of this, of what practice of architecture is, you have to be licensed, and that's across the country. And we'll talk about that in Illinois, different states, how they handle that. And then we're going to talk about agency. Agency is going to be kind of the legal part that I'm going to sneak in the middle of the lecture, and what an agent is and how agency works in construction and architecture, in the construction industry, and then in general, where it works in the world and everything else like that. And then we'll talk about forms of association. When you eventually, some of you guys may eventually hang your own shingle, and what kind of company do you want to be? Or you'll work for a company, and what are those companies, what are those structures and everything else. So a little bit more business related, not as much of the architecture, but the legal, but there are going to be some legal stuff we'll throw in here. So without further ado, let's talk about licensing of architects. So the first thing we want to do, what's the purpose of licensing architects? Well, there's a public interest. You want to protect the public from incompetent design. So there has to be, and if you think about it, we're going to go through the world as we look at it, or how I lecture, whether it's anything different or not, it's called a profession. It's the profession of architecture. I'm in the profession of law. So you have, traditionally you think about it as architects, engineers, lawyers, doctors, accountants. There are some construction elements, some builders that have to be licensed, but the whole point is that you want to make sure that the public is protected. And the way you do that is you have to set standards. And the standards are, where you start is, you have to take a licensing exam. Have you met the minimum requirements to go out and be a practicing architect and license so that the state has at least done their job in the beginning to make sure that the public is protected. There's also a business interest. And this is the one that, interestingly enough, I practiced construction law for many, many years and worked for architecture firms when I was in college and everything else. And I never really thought about this until my partner, who used to teach this class 15, 18 years ago, he talked about this. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So as a business interest is, we want to make sure now we're just talking about the profession of architects, or when I'm talking about myself as a lawyer, we want to make sure that we have a controlled interest. So not only does the state have an interest of making sure that the public is protected, we want to make sure that we are not in competition, so to speak, with everybody out on the streets. And neither would you as the public. You wouldn't want to have somebody who just says they're a lawyer but never went to law school and didn't know anything about being a lawyer be your representative. So the architects have a protected interest in being a licensed profession. Number one, it helps them stand out, so people come to them as a licensed architect. Number two, when you start taking a look at who are the people that might actually be practicing, do we want a interior designer that, and this is not a disparagement to interior designers, because I've done a lot of interior work as freelance over my, I paid for part of my law school, I worked and did freelance interior stuff. But do we want someone that is used to picking out furniture and colors and stuff like that, designing the high-rise without the experience and stuff like that? No. So as an architect, I want to protect that I have this education, that I learned all this stuff and that I earned that degree. So I want to use that and say, you have to be licensed to be part of my team. You have to make sure. Now, again, there's going to be people out here, whether it's you guys in this class or people that are practicing out in the industry, there are many people that work for architecture firms that never take their ARE. They never get their license. That doesn't mean that they're not practicing architecture, and we'll talk about how that's done when we go through that. But you have to work for someone that is licensed. So, I'm sure you've heard that you have to seal the drawings. I'm sure maybe you've heard that term. Every drawing that goes into the building department has to have an architect or an engineer seal on it, and that someone is licensed, they have a licensing number, so forth and so on. So that's the protected business interest. I don't want other people, just the average Jane or Joe, to come in and do what I do that I worked so hard for and that I got myself and took an exam to be licensed for. So Now, how do we regulate that? Who is the entity that regulates that? Well, in Illinois, there's the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, the IDFPR. A few years ago, maybe probably 10 years ago, they added the F in there. So it used to be the IDPR, but now it's the IDFPR. Because financial, is they also regulate accountants. So they wanted to throw that in, and people that do that financial. There's some certified financial planners, the people that have to be certified and have to be licensed for that. It's an administrative agency that's over the profession. So each profession has a department in the IDFPR. So there's an architectural, there's an engineering, there's a doctor, there's a, you know, everyone has their own specific department that is over that. And that agency creates the standards and regulations. Now, they don't write the exam. The exam, they look to people like the professionals that put together the ARE. But they say, for example, in the state of Illinois, before you can be licensed, you need to have 8 years of education, and then you need to sit for the ARE. Now, the interesting thing is, because I don't know how many of you guys went to architecture school undergrad, probably most of you did not, you're like, but I'm in a three-year class. How am I going to get licensed? Well, the regulation that's written by the IDFPR for architects says education includes practicing or working for someone that's licensed, so it's in the field. So for the first number of years that you're out and you're working for an architecture firm, you're getting education in the eyes of the state. So that's what ends up happening, and then after you have your 8 years of education under the state of what's qualified as education, you can sit for your AREs. And then you become a licensed architect, and then you can hang your own shingle, you can hire your own people, whatever you want to do with that. The regulations have the force of law. So if we go back, and I have, if you go back, I put the hierarchy of law. Remember our hierarchy of law table? Well, it's going to fall into the administrative bodies. If you remember, it's the Constitution, then it's statutes, then it's the executive order, then it's the administrative body. So it's more specific than the legislature. What ends up happening is you have the legislature in Illinois. It's going to be the Illinois House and Senate. They're going to, they don't want to have the burden of regulating all the professions. So what they do is they create, they, the legislative body in the state, and this happens in all the different states, they create a law that says we can have an organization, an administrative organization called the IDFPR. And we are now going to give, as the legislative body, because we represent the entire state, we are going to give the power to regulate the architects to this administrative body. And so, as the legislature, we have a very general statement that says the IDFPR is going to create the law, the rules and regulations to govern the administration and the licensing of architects. That's all they say, and they have funding for it and goes to that, and that's what done. And then it takes the agency, the IDFPR, to make the specific requirements because they're the experts in the field. So that's how it works. And so that's where you want to look into where this falls into the hierarchy. It'll fall into the administrative body. And then you'll be able to see which laws could trump it and which laws are below it. So when you take a look at that. And I will come back to the hierarchy throughout the semester. I've already told you for sure there will be a table, a question. I hope you guys all mark that one slide. There'll be a very easy question on that. There may be a little bit more that talks about how do the bodies work together or whichever. But there's going to be a question that says, which is the highest in the hierarchy of law or something like that. So, any questions on this? Great. So, if you violate one of these regulations, there's going to be sanctions. And that's the other thing that the government provided, the legislature, when providing the authority to the IDFPR, they gave them the authority to also find sanction. So the first, or create sanctions if you violate those licensing statutes. The first thing we have fines, penalties. If you have violated something about their things, the IDFPR can fine you money that you have to pay to the state. You don't pay to the injured party, yeah, that may be part of a lawsuit, but you have to pay that fine to the state. They can deny your license upon subsequent application. So you've been licensed for the year 2026. Sometime during the course of that year, you violated one of their regulations. When you apply for your license, because every year you need to reapply. I reapply for my law license every year, and if they have you've had a fine or penalty, they can say, no, we're not giving it to you. So that's one thing that then you can't practice architecture. This is an interesting one. You have the inability to sue for fees where you have to forfeiture all your fees. If you are not licensed in the state of Illinois and you practice with a capital P architecture and you send a bill out but you're not licensed, technically you're not allowed to charge for those bills, for your work. There's a case from the 70s in where there was a gentleman, he was an architect, and he was licensed as an individual. He was a sole practitioner. He opened up his shop as Bob Smith Architects. And he incorporated it because he wanted to protect his money and everything else. And he signed all his contracts, Bob Smith Architecture. Not Bob Smith, Bob Smith Architecture. Got into a lawsuit over, ironically, a house that had the wrong color of bricks. But it was a fairly big lawsuit at the time. I believe it was for like $6,000. You read this, you're like, how did this actually go all the way to trial and then to the appellate court? He got sticked by his client for $6,000 for designing that house back in the early 70s, and he sued for it. And the state came back, or the law came back, the court of law, and said, Bob Smith Architecture is not a licensed organization in the state of Illinois. Bob Smith is, but Bob Smith didn't do this contract, Bob Smith Architecture. They're two different entities, and we'll get to that forms of association in the third part of the class. And so they said, if Bob Smith had signed this contract, you would be able to get your $6,000. But since it was Bob Smith Architecture, that entity was practicing architecture without a license, so you can't collect your money. So, that's if you break a law, you can't even get your money that you're owed. He did a good job. I mean, it was a wrong color brick, blah, blah, blah. But he ended up not able to collect the money. So it doesn't matter whether it's $6,000 or $600,000. And I have a case that I dealt with on that one. If they arise, your issues with sanctions and violations mostly are going to arise in this area. In this area of not being licensed. You're going to have fines and penalties from time to time. But that may be like, it may fall into an ethical issue where someone has committed fraud. In architecture, luckily, whether you want to go bad or otherwise, you guys are all out there and working very hard and you're practicing and you're going to make sure that you do a good job. And if something holds in a lawsuit, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be because you had negligent work. Your work was not to the standard of care. That's not a violation of the regulations. That just means you were a crappy architect for that project. That doesn't mean you violated the statute of, because you were still a practicing licensed architect. You just were a crappy practicing licensed architect. And so maybe you got sued for negligence. That's not a violation. But if where you're going to find the violations, again, is sometimes when people aren't licensed. And the client, there's a question, just in general. Should the client avoid paying for fees simply because of a license? I mean, is that fair? One of the things that that I had a case, this was many, many years ago, I got a call from an architect out of Philadelphia, fairly prominently known architect in that region. I hadn't heard of him, but apparently was very well known in the Philadelphia area. And he had he asked me to be his lawyer, and he started going through this whole big deal. And you guys all know like Hard Rock Cafe. So this is back, you know, like I said, probably 20 years ago. Hard Rock had just kind of exploded on the scene. It started in a number of small places, like not smaller, but only a few locations. And all of a sudden, like, all the big cities had it. New York had one, Chicago had one, LA had one. You're like, all of a sudden they were popping up. And then there were these other themed restaurants. There was one called Rainforest Cafe, and then there was another one, Planet Hollywood, and like, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone and other people were like the financial backers for Planet Hollywood, and you'd walk in and there'd be statues and all the memorabilia. So the themed restaurant was like a big deal at the time. So this guy, this architect that called me, he had been hired by what we called at the time the Irish Cowboys. There was 4 investors from Ireland, and they had a lot of money, and it was at the time when the EU was opening up, and everybody was going through Ireland first because of their tax breaks. So a lot of people got rich very quickly in Ireland, and so there was lots of cash for investments in the United States for probably a 5 to 8 year period of time where there was a ton of Irish investments. So these four Irish Cowboys, that's what my client called them, said, we want to do a themed restaurant, and the theme of the restaurant was Mars 2112. I guess one of the guys was a huge Rush fan, because there's an album called 2112 that Rush did. But they were all big into science fiction. And so they made this restaurant. When you walked in, as you went in, it felt like you were on the planet Mars. And they served these drinks that smoked, and there was aliens and whatever. And they built one in New York City, and it was very successful. And so they were going to come and develop one here in Chicago. So they started working on it, and as I learned later, this client of mine was very difficult to deal with. And so the lead architect who worked and did the designs for the New York project, he left the company. And he went in with this other company and he stole all the drawings. And my client had been sniffed by the people who were developing the Irish Cowboys. They didn't pay my client $600,000 before the lead architect left. So not only did this lead architect steal the drawings, but my client was out $600,000. So it was a big case. I'm like, I got a copyright infringement case, I got a $600,000 claim, I got pretty easy facts, this is a unique restaurant, nobody else is going to be doing this, we know it's being developed because it's been in the newspapers. I mean, this was a really, I won't say a slam dunk case, because there's no such thing in the law, but I'm like, this is great. So I dove in, and I listened to this guy, and apparently his father used to be a federal judge out on the West Coast many, many years before, so he, of course, knew more about the law than I did, just ask him. But we would talk about stuff all the time, and we would get there, and we started putting the case together. And then we sued the other side, filed a lawsuit, and then you get what's called discovery. Remember we talked about discovery a couple weeks ago, we were talking about the anatomy of the case. Discovery, the other side sends you document requests. Send me all these types of documents. And one of the documents they asked me for was the licensing statute, the licensure, the proof that this company was licensed in the state of Illinois. Well, my client had been licensed in 27 different states. He was well known, and he was licensed in Illinois. He had been licensed in Illinois for like 25 years. But the company that he created to design this space, his architecture firm, he had never applied for a license. That firm was licensed in like 16 or 18 states, but he was never licensed in Illinois. So we're like a year and a half into this case, and he was paying our bills very slowly, but he was paying, luckily, and I had to call him up and tell him about this. And I said, I need you to understand something. We can't collect your fees, like the $600,000, much less sue for copyright infringement, because you're not licensed in the state of Illinois. And I said, I know we have a good case, but this is what's going to happen. The other side doesn't know it yet, because not only is there a potential that they won't have to pay us the $600,000, there's also potential that they could sue us for wrongful lawsuit, and then we have to pay their legal fees. So I'm telling my client, I'm like, you're looking at a blip of this. Not only you're not going to get your $600,000 back, but you may have to write them a big check. We've been spending lots of money on everything else. And I said, my recommendation is we dismiss this case. I know you're out $600,000, but this is where you're... He was so mad. Hung up on me, called me back, hung up on me again a couple days later. We ultimately dropped the case because I sent him case law, and I talked to him. He has a local counsel in there. We talked to his local counsel and everything else. Because this was what had happened. Because he was practicing architecture, practicing with a capital P, without being licensed. So it's a big deal, this whole point about whether you can get your fees or not. I say that, and I say that because it's an interesting case that I was able to do this. It's like I would have never known. I think that most construction lawyers go throughout their whole career not knowing about the fact that if you're not licensed, you're not thinking that the individual is licensed, but the company is not. But I have, from time to time, in clients that I've represented, architects that I've represented, when we go and start to develop a project in a new state, I have helped them out to say, we make sure you apply. Applying for your license, if you're licensed in one state to the next, as a company, is not a big deal. And so we've saved them the risk of this happening. So, again, when you're out there, and if you're hanging your own shingle, you go work for a small company and you get a commission, you or your boss get the commission for something in Wisconsin. It's only a 45-minute drive across the border. Make sure that not only the individual architect, but the company is licensed in that area. So, question? Oh, that's a great question. So the question was, does both the company and the individual have to be licensed? And the answer to that is yes. Because the way the laws are put together, and this is not in my lecture, that's why I really like that question, because I can give a little bit more. The way the laws are written is to be a licensed firm, depending on what state you have to have a certain percentage of the people that are the ownership of the firm being the licensed architect. In Illinois, I believe it's 1/3. So if you have 3 people, you have to have at least 1 of the 3 people of the ownership. They can hire as employees 6,000 people. It's the ownership. I believe it's 1/3. It may be 50%. Different states are different. Some are 1/3, some are 2/3, some are half. I believe Illinois is 1/3, but so in order to apply for your license in whatever state you are, you have to identify the company, apply for the license. You have to identify the owners of that company and who of those owners are licensed in the state in which you're applying for the company license. And so long as you have the proper number of individuals that are licensed that are required by each different state statute, then the company itself could be licensed. So, question.
So does that work for like shared ownership? It was like a company owns for an employee-owned company?
So like a corporation where everybody has stockholders or an LLC where there's membership and things like that, which we'll talk about later about how those things work. But the answer is yes. And what the law says, though, is we don't look at the shareholders because they're just individuals or the members in an LLC. What we now look at is the officers and agents of the company, so the president, the officers. So while they may be an ownership and they become a professional corporation, and so the ownership sits on like a board or they have their titles, president, vice president, principal, whatever those people are. Those are considered the owners of the company for purposes of the statute. So that's what they will look at. So if you're a principal, you're traditionally the principal is the term that's used in architecture as an owner. And so that's who you would list on your thing. In the law, it's called a partner. Question?
Is there like a limit? Have 15 owners?
Oh no, you can have as many as you want. I mean, you think about the huge firms like Gensler or SOM or you know, like they're going to have many, many architects that are licensed in many, many states. I mean, that's what this gentleman from Philadelphia. I mean, he himself was licensed in Illinois. There were other people that were licensed, and he was able. He could have easily just filed the application and got enough people in. It was not going to be a problem. So when you get firms that are bigger and bigger and as they grow, and that's the other thing that I have advised clients from time to time, architecture firms, when they want to open an office. They're going to open an office and maybe there's only 3 architects, like a Boston office, like they would be a Chicago firm, we're going to open a small Boston office. They're going to look to see who's practicing in Boston. Like, if I'm an Illinois licensed architect and an owner, but I'm not practicing in Boston, I don't need to be one of the people that is listed. So like if I have 3 architects in Boston and 2 of those 3 are licensed in Massachusetts, we can open the Boston office and it can be registered because we're looking at who's practicing there. It all comes into those questions. So different states look at different things. Question? No. Different states. Each state will have a different one. Some are 1/3, some are 50%. Even as I'm sitting here today, like I do these lectures without my notes because I've been doing this for so many years, and I have looked at the Illinois law, but I really can't remember right now because I've had people open up architectural firms. I can't remember if it's 50% or 1/3 in Illinois. But each state will have its different one, and it'll be set by a regulation that's put together by the IDFPR. So, yes. There is, in fact, and certain states will allow you to, if you practice architecture in a certain region, so many years out of so many, like maybe 5 out of 7 years you've practiced in Illinois, and you go apply for a license in Wisconsin, I think that's what it is, or Michigan, the closer states, and I'll tell you that why in a second, then you can get your license, you don't have to take another exam. Now, the reason why I say it's often regional, geographic, if you want to go practice in California, there's no reciprocity because there's earthquakes there, so you have to take that. If you want to practice in Florida or the Sunbelt states, there's no reciprocity because remember when I was talking about competition? Well, there's so many people that want to retire down there. And if I'm an architect that never sat for an exam in Arizona and I'm now in my mid-60s and I'm going to go live the great life and I love the Cubs, so I'm going to go move to Arizona and watch the Grapefruit League and blah, 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 in the spring training. The person who's been in Arizona all their life and practicing doesn't want me to come in and take their job. So there's laws in the nicer states, nicer for warm and weather, the retirement states, that say if you want to practice in our states, you must take the exam. We're not giving you any reciprocity. So Illinois, Wisconsin, like, who cares? We love Illinois and Wisconsin here, but I mean, you know what I'm saying. But like, when you want to go to Florida, they're like, stay away. And in fact, I have friends, and it's the same with almost all the professions, like the bar. The, if you look at the states, like, you have to, if I wanted to practice in California, I've been practicing law for 30-some years, I can't practice without taking the exam. Florida, all those states, the same with me, because they don't want the competition. That's that whole licensing, regulation, business aspect of it. So, okay. Moving on. A couple more things about licensing. When we have, there's two different types of licensing statutes. The first one is what's called, and each state may have a different mix of this. The first one is called a holding out statute. So, it simply requires the design professional to use a particular label. When you are advertising, when you are telling people what you do, you are saying, Mike Hanahan, architect. I say the word architect because that's what I am. I am holding out to the public that I am an architect. Now, to say Mike Hanahan architect, I must be licensed, because the law says if we're in a holding out state, if you are going to tell people you're an architect, you must be licensed. And oh, by the way, you must tell people that you're an architect, so you must be licensed. So, it does not regulate the work. The holding out statute doesn't regulate what your work does. It just says, how do you tell the people? And you must tell the people that you're an architect, but the only way you can do that is licensed. And it allows the public to know the licensed architect is competent, but nothing for the unlicensed. So there's nothing that says, like, if I want to be a designer, you can say, Mike Hanahan, designer, well, I'm not an architect. I can hold myself out as a designer, but I'm not a licensed architect. Now, the interesting thing is most of the public doesn't know this, so they may walk into my shop as a designer. I'm like, yeah, I can design this, I can do whatever and everything else. And I have not held myself out as an architect, so I'm not in violation of the statute. But I am practicing architecture, and remember, to practice architecture in that state or any state, you need to be licensed. So, this holding out doesn't regulate my work. They don't look to say, just because I'm a designer doing that, you can't do it, but I should know that I can't do it because I'm in violation of the Act. Does that make sense? Question?
So how does that work with like junior and entry level people who are not going to be licensed working at the designer position?
So we'll get there? That's coming up. I don't know if it's in this part here. No, it'll be another slide. So, but I'll answer it anyway, and then we come so we can repeat it again. So you are allowed to practice, with a capital P, architecture, so long as the licensed architect is overseeing your work. And the statute, the Illinois statute, actually talks about that. It specifically states that we are allowed to have this overseeing of the work and what that requires. And I will tell you, during my lifetime, that has changed. When I worked years and years ago, way back when I was in college, I worked for an interior architectural firm. It was actually an architecture firm. We had two people on our that were owners that were licensed architects, but we only did interior work. But that allowed us to do structural interior work. Like the business, the firm decided we don't want to build high rises and everything else, but there's plenty of people that have office buildings that we're going to redo and renovate. And so sometimes you have to move bathrooms, and sometimes you have to do lighting systems and everything else. So all those things require a licensed architect. And so when I first started working for them, they needed to have certain things of the engineering, because they had architects, but they didn't have electrical engineers, and they didn't have structural engineers. They needed to have those portions of the drawings sealed. Well, there was a shop literally four stores down that was an engineering company, and we take our drawings, and we send them down to them. And this was actually when they were physical drawings. And they would look them over, and they would seal them and send them back, and we'd pay them a fee, and then we'd file our drawings with the state, and that was legal. They didn't see anything of how the process was done. They weren't part of any of the design. That was okay for many years, decades. Now, I'm going back into the 80s when we were talking about when I worked for this company, so it's been decades since it's changed. But now, it requires somebody to actually be involved. You can't just oversee and just say, yeah, that looks good, stamp and move on. They actually have to be involved. And so if there are going to be problems with negligence and you get into this discovery phase, they'll probably look at your billing records or your timesheets. They're going to see how many hours did the senior person actually have in the design. Similar in law, like the associates of my law firm are all licensed lawyers. You have to be licensed no matter what. There's no apprenticeship in the law like there is in architecture. But if there's negligence by that a lawyer commits negligence or malpractice, let's say some young lawyer commits malpractice inadvertently, but it's still a malpractice action, the lawsuit's going to go against the law firm. And the people at the law firm that are going to be hurt is not the associate, it's going to be the partners that own the firm. And so there's still things that what we have in our firm, and most firms, I don't know every firm because I haven't worked for every firm, but every firm I've ever worked for, requires that when we file something with the courts, there has to be a partner signature name and the associate, even if the associate does all the work, because the ownership of the company needs to be on that. So, as a really quick aside to that, when I was a third year in law school, so I was getting ready, I had my job lined up for when I graduated and everything else, there was this news that came out, it was a Chicago Tribune, it was a big deal. There was a partner, big partner, at one of the largest law firms in the Illinois area and in the country. National firm, huge company. And this guy was super smart. And he had been at the firm, he'd been a partner for 10 years. And he was one of their biggest rainmakers. Turned out his third year, because he was so smart, he had taken extra classes and everything else, he had a very light load his second semester of his third year of law school. And one of them was a self-directed, he had to just create a paper and an essay and hand it in. He never did. So he went to the graduation ceremony, never told his parents that he never actually graduated. He walked, but they don't hand out the diploma at that one. You just kind of stand up, you throw your cap, you stand up, so he rented his cap and gown. Never graduated from law school. As a result, he never took the bar. He went to Barbary with all his friends. That's the prep course. And he would go every day, it was 5 days a week for the whole summer, and he'd study and learn and everything else, but he went to the bar. He didn't take the bar because he couldn't sign up because he wasn't a graduate from architecture school. He had already had his job with this giant firm because he had worked for them the summer before his third year, and they made an offer for him to go work for them. So he went to go work for them, having never graduated from law school and having never taken the licensing exam. Worked for them for, like I said, 10 years, ultimately became a partner, a huge rainmaker. And then it came out because they were sued and there was a discovery thing, and it turned out that he had never been licensed. So every single one of the cases that he had ever been on, the firm, because they had an unlicensed lawyer working on it, would have committed malpractice. It was huge because you have all these cases of, because he was a corporate lawyer, so we're talking over the 10 years, hundreds of millions of dollars that they won or lost or everything else. Luckily, the firm was smart that every single pleading and filing that he ever was involved in had another partner on it. Even when he became a partner, because he worked in conjunction, and maybe he was smart enough to know, I got to have somebody else on there. So the firm never got sued because they protected themselves, and they always had a licensed lawyer who was involved on the cases. But it was a huge deal with this guy. I mean, it was I remember we were in law school and we were reading about this in the trivia, oh my God, this is such a big deal. So make sure you graduate this year. Hopefully it won't be because of me. And then you can take your AREs later. So practice statute. Get back to the slide. So we have the holding out. Then we have another subsection called practice statute. And it prohibits the practice without a license. So you have to have a license to practice. You're not holding yourself out. You don't have to tell people. You just have to make sure you're licensed. What is the definition, though, of architectural services? That's one of the questions that comes in. And as I was talking about, is an interior designer practicing architecture? Is a landscape architect practicing architecture? Well, the various states and regulations of their own IDFPRs of the different states will start to define what actually is the practice of architecture. It may include that you have to have an engineering element to it, structural, civil, mechanical, things like that. But you cannot contract with an unlicensed architect. This goes back to this case I talked about in Illinois. They weren't licensed. The firm wasn't licensed. The individual was. So technically, that contract, if we go back 2 weeks ago, was void from the beginning. When you enter into the contract with Mike Hanahan Architecture, if that entity is not licensed, it's not allowed to do business in the state, and therefore that contract was illegal, so it was void because it was in violation of law. So that contract never existed, and that's the reason why when the decision came down on this case in the 70s about the $6,000, the court ruled as they did. They said Bob Smith Architecture never had a contract, never was practicing, it was void from the beginning, so you can't sue for breach of contract because you never had a contract in the beginning. Make sense? Okay. Illinois. What does Illinois have? And I know you guys have the slides without like the zooming in and stuff like that. Illinois is a hybrid state. Both are required. In Illinois, both you must be licensed as a practice. You're practicing, you must be licensed to practice. And when you hold yourself out, you must say you're an architect so everybody knows. You can't say, if you're just a designer that's unlicensed, you can't say, I'm an architect, that's in violation of the Act. If you are practicing, you must say you're an architect. It doesn't have to be in everybody's name, it doesn't have to be in the logo. I mean, you know, like Gensler, it's not Gensler, Architects in Illinois. But you holding yourself out, you must do both in order to practice in Illinois. Many states are hybrids. Many states do that because, again, the more information to the public, the better protected the public are. So, and then this back clear, the question of who decides what practicing architecture is, I just talked about that. It's going to be the regulatory bodies as far as if you get into the issues of whether you have practiced without a license, they're going to get into those questions. But it could, depending on if it's part of a suit, let's say that the wall fell down that you designed because you were negligent, and the party that's injured is going to sue you. Let's say it fell on a worker's leg and they crushed their knee, and so there's a $1 million lawsuit against the architectural firm. In the course of that lawsuit, information will come out, and maybe the judge or jury will not only say that you're negligent, but they may also say, and oh, by the way, it looks like you violated these statutes. That may go against you even further. The judge or jury may make the damage awards even higher because you knew you were practicing without a license. And then the IDFBR is going to come in and fine you or make sure that you don't get to apply for a license the next time around. So it can have ripple effects when you do that. So, question back there. So, yes, the answer to that is yes. And in fact, I've worked on some projects where I had a couple of housing projects, like residential, high-end residential, and so they'll hire a design architect. And a lot of times that design architect may not be from the state, it may not be licensed, and so what they end up having to do is they have to hire an architect that's in the jurisdiction that's licensed. This happens all the time where you don't have an office in Boston or wherever it might be. So you do have to hire a local architect, and that local architect, when we start looking at when the building permit is issued and the drawings are sealed, the local architect, separate contract, will have to be licensed in that area. And so the owner now has two contracts, and the first one says I'm design only, and the second one says I'm responsible or what's called the architect of record. And so if there are structural or civil or engineering problems and there are the practice of architecture, the architecture of something goes wrong, that's going to fall on the architect of record. The designer may be brought in because the owner probably, because we're in America, we sue everybody, but it may not be that the standard of care that design architect needs to follow is as high because they aren't responsible for structural, mechanical, electrical, civil, etc. Because they're more in the schematic design and design development phase, and they're the early stuff. I've done that many times. I had a house out in New York, and they had a French designer, a guy from France. When we did the Haribo factory, we started with the German designers, and the reason why we didn't stay with them is because they didn't want to have someone that had to live in the U.S. for 3 years, become licensed in here, and so they shipped the drawings over here, and we hired a licensed U.S. architectural and engineering firm, and then they did the conversion and everything else. But you don't really say, I can't be sued. What you say is, this is the scope of my services, and it's limited to this scope. I actually worked on a contract yesterday from a landscape architect, and they put in that kind of language, we can't be sued for this and this and this. I struck it. I said, And my response to the attorney was, let's not talk about which can't be sued. Let's talk about what your scope is. And that I will. And I allowed them to say, we are not reviewing the drawings for structural, mechanical, electrical, civil. We're not doing that. We're just doing landscape architecture. But I didn't want him to say we can't. And they literally said, there can be no action against the blah, blah, blah. We struck that because I just thought, you don't want to do that. You don't want to agree to that in words. But you want to talk about your scope. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? All right, one more slide, I think, on licensing, or two. Practicing architecture without a license, and some of this were kind of repeat. This is your question here. You have to at least practice under the supervision of a licensed architect, and that's that fly-by review. Used to be legal in lots of states, the fly-by review was okay. Back in the 80s, when we were doing this interior architecture work, that's what we did. We sent it down the street, they had it for a day or two, sent it back, we wrote them a check. That was the flyby. No longer in across the country. Reciprocity for out of state. So the reason why we can have this, and there was a question, I'm not sure, which somebody asked the reciprocity. The reason why you can have that is because there is also a national board. Each state is going to have their individual, but there's a national board, the National Council for Architectural Registration Board, the NCARB. NCARB is involved with helping to prepare your AREs. They are going to create a national standard. So in the law, there is the bar that we take, and there's two sections. Some states have three sections, but in Illinois there's two sections. There's what's called there's the essay Illinois section, where you get a problem and your response, you have to write an essay of how you would solve that problem legally, and who is responsible for this, and where does the liabilities happen, and everything else. And then when I took it, that was, I don't remember if it was day one or day two, but there's eight essays in the morning, eight essays in the afternoon. So 16 essays, and when I was doing, you had to write. Now everything's on computer, but like your hand would cramp up and everything else because you had to write all these answers. So that's half the test. The other half was called the multi-state. The multi-state is the exact same 150 questions all around the country. That's how they do the bar exam. So the ARE, and that's to create a kind of model standard that every lawyer is going to be taking the multi-state exam. And that's the same thing with the AREs here, is there's going to be a national standard. There may be specific questions from state to state, like the third day, maybe in California, one of your days is about engineering, infrastructural mechanics, and everything dealing with earthquakes. So there's going to be additional parts. But the point is that there still is, while we are a country governed from state to state, there is a national interest for commerce and business to allow an architect that has an office in Michigan to have an office in Illinois, an office in Vegas, and an office in Dallas. And they can expand, and then we know that there is at least some consistency with this ARE. This listed here is some of the various elements you're going to have to take: structural systems, building design and construction system, building systems. This class will fall under construction documents and service. So the CDS element of the AREs, when you ultimately take that section, you may be listening to my lectures again, especially if you go to Amber Book, because he just cribs off of me. He's a nice guy, though. Question? Oh, is that the old section? Okay, thanks. Then I'll have to fix that. I appreciate that. Okay, good. Okay, good. All right. Thank you for that. I'll change that. Maybe I'll do that before I then update these slides. So, and then this other thing I talked about a bunch, warm versus cold states, is the warm states or the vacation states or the retirement states. Those are going to have, you're going to have to take a licensing exam no matter what. Doesn't matter how long you pass. Cold states, come on up, please. You know, if you practice long enough, we need more people up here. So that's where you're going to see a division in that, and whether you're licensed or not. Question? So the answer is I don't know, because you would have to go to Louisiana and find out what their reciprocity laws are. It's possible, but my guess is that Louisiana may be a state, even though it's a sun state, it's a warm state. They may say, we still need more people in here because it's a less populated state. You know, if you think about it, I'm not sure if I know anybody that's retired to Louisiana. I know a lot of people that retired in Florida. I know a lot of people retired in Mexico or in Arizona or California. But I don't know. I mean, so when you get to that state, you'll find out what the reciprocity is, and they'll let you know on that. So Good question, though. All right. And then who is licensed? This was almost all the stuff we've already covered. Firm versus individual, firm and individual. That's that whole thing about the individual versus the company and stuff. So I don't want to go over that again. If you guys all understand that, what we talked about. Question there.
So there are two ways to try to get a license. First of all, if someone has a license. The second one, I'm just trying to bring down to do some problems with the state office
there.
Basically, some additional things that you're doing to.
Yeah, what will happen is that you'll still have to apply for a license. Well, if you go to a holding out state, let's say it's a pure holding out state, and you're licensed in the state of Michigan, and you have been licensed for 5 out of 7 years, so you go to, let's say, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm just using this as an example. Let's say Wisconsin is a pure holding out state, and Wisconsin has a reciprocity that says if you've practiced architecture for 5 out of 7 years in these various states, one being Illinois, you can practice architecture in Wisconsin without taking our exam, so you're not licensed in Wisconsin, you've gained reciprocity, and you can hold yourself out as an architect because you're licensed in Illinois. That could happen. That's one way to do that. It just depends on what the state requires. But most states are going to require most states are hybrid or only practicing, which says a practice when you must have your license in order to do that. So, okay? Question back there. All the paperwork has to be filled out. Exactly. Everything has to be filled out. The reason why is because in order to do business, and we'll get there when we get to second semester, I'll talk about it a lot more. In order to do business in any state, you have to be licensed to do business. I mean, if you have, maybe not my daughter when she used to put the lemonade stand up at the corner of the street, but if you have a company and you are doing business, you have to register because you have to pay taxes as a company and what kind of company you are. Is it a sole proprietorship? Is it a partnership? Is it a corporation? Is it an LLC? All those things that have nothing to do with architecture, but architecture is a business. So you have, I am licensed, and I have to prove that I am licensed, so that's my licensure and practicing in the state of Illinois, and I have a business, and I'm operating as a business and an architect. I'm registered with the government as my type of business. Oh, by the way, since it's architecture, here's my attachments that show I'm licensed, and I follow those rules as well. So there are forms to fill out. Okay. Questions on licensing and regulations. These are to you guys. If an architect can pass the company exam, why should the degree or experience matter? Like, why should it matter that in Illinois you have to have 8 years of education? If you can take the exam right when you graduate, why should it matter? Questions? Ideas? Thoughts? Come on.
It's hours.
Pardon me?
Hours.
What do you mean by hours? Like experience. How many hours, how much experience you've done that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of what it is. You have a thought?
I was going to say, it probably has something to do with the fact that it's theory versus practice. So if you can pass the exam, that's a demonstration of your theoretical understanding of the practice of architecture, but the experience hours are like a demonstration of
yeah. Yeah. Right
there. You have to sort of like industry standards and aspects that maybe want architects in the field to have like common understandings of like history and like aesthetic principles and all that in addition to being like making mistakes.
And the last thing you just said is probably the most important thing you just said. What did you say, the last part?
Making mistakes that would be different from the exam.
No, but they have to create a standard. And so they want to make sure that you're not just theoretically, like you said, and have this knowledge to pass an exam. We all are smart. We can all pass an exam. But and not that, that your example is exactly right. Your example is right because they all fall into the same thing. The government wants to protect the public interest. That's going to be like a theme throughout the whole class. There's a public interest here, protecting the public. And so creating standards of how much you practice, the degree of experience matters over just because you can take an exam. So years and years ago, by the way, this is going back 60, 70 years ago, you didn't have to have like, and this is my knowledge more on the law than anything else. I want to say it's in the 40s, late 40s that it changed. You did not have to take the bar to be a lawyer. You could just work for law firms and work for lawyers as clerks and then as a paralegal, move your way up. And there's a famous case of an Illinois lawyer, and I think it was like 1948 or 49 was the last person he was sworn in, not sworn in, but he practiced law, but never had taken the bar, because it was experience that they looked at. And experience is important that this individual had done this. And many people had done this for decades and decades. You worked as an apprentice under somebody's auspice and somebody's teaching. So, but that's the biggest reason why, just because you can pass an exam, shouldn't be the bar. It should also be the experience. You have to do both. This question I'm going to answer for you. Does having a license prevent incompetence? Absolutely not. That's why I have a job. People are going to be, and not that they're purposely incompetent. I mean, sometimes there are some people that do some bad things, but people screw up. We're human. And does that mean you're incompetent? Maybe you're negligent. Or maybe you are incompetent. So just because, and this goes with the experience part, just because you take an exam and you show that you can pass the exam, and just because you've worked for somebody for 8 years or had education, quote-unquote education according to Illinois, for 8 years, doesn't mean you are competent. Especially like if I learned and was, my tutelage was designing houses, and then somebody retains me to design a hospital. Do I have the competency to do that? So just because you have a license doesn't mean you are competent. And these are warnings for the general public as well as that. What about licensing interior architects, landscape architects, or contractors for design services? That's the other part of that business side of it. So I was the lawyer for when they did, I think I told you guys this, the horizontal renovation of Navy Pier. It was about a 6 or 8 year project that we worked over it. And we brought in James Cornerfield Architects, which is a landscape architectural firm out of New York. Fabulous, amazing work. And we put together a team of 14 different designers. And some of those designers were specifically because they were licensed here in Illinois, because they needed, they being some of the high end, I don't believe James Corner was ultimately licensed in the state of Illinois to practice architecture, but there was enough people on the team that the drawings that needed to be sealed were sealed by licensed architects. So there was regulation of different people of who, and that team could have been smaller, but the Navy Pier wanted some of these high named designers involved. And so the locals, not that they were thinking of it this way, said we have to have people locally. And that gave more business to them. So that allows you to make sure that landscape architects don't do stuff they shouldn't do, or things like, you know, an interior designer doesn't design an office building or what have you. We keep in our lanes, so to speak. What about insurance license versus... What about the insurance for licensed versus unlicensed? Like all of you guys, when you get out there, hopefully your company, or if you hang your own shingle, you're going to have malpractice insurance. It's called E&O, Errors and Omissions Insurance. And we talk about torts next week. I think we'll talk a little bit about insurance. It's kind of boring. I don't think I have any questions on exam insurance, but you got to know it exists. Can you be insured as an architect if you are not licensed? Who thinks yes? Can you be insured if you're not licensed? Who thinks yes? Okay, who thinks no? Okay, so like two-thirds of the class, so we've got the rest of them are like undecided, which is okay. You cannot be licensed, you cannot be insured as a licensed architect if you're not licensed. You can't be insured for that. You can be insured for a designer, but that insurance policy will cover much less. So, if you're not licensed, but you want to practice architecture, you're never going to get the insurance, and then you're out there on the women of prayer. I had a client early in my career. He was downstate Illinois. He did tiny little, like, barn renovations and stuff. Nothing was ever of any of significant, you know, big projects, because he was in a small little town. There was probably 2,000, 3,000 people in his town. He never carried insurance. And his thought process was, if I don't have insurance, they know there's no money because I'm a sole practitioner and I work off of my desk. He didn't have a computer, he didn't do CAD, so I'm worth nothing. He at least, as a sole practitioner, as a company, he had separated himself personally from the company. And he's like, so even if I get sued, they're not going to get anything from me, so I get out of lawsuits faster. Very interesting philosophy. We told him all the time to get a license, because I know I represented him twice and my partner had represented him at least once before. I'm like, okay, you've been sued at least 3 times in the last 5 years. You should get some insurance. I don't know if he ever did, but that was his philosophy. He was licensed. He could have gotten insurance, but he didn't get it. I was like, But we use it in our settlement discussions. He says, Mike, offer him $5,000, tell him that's all he's going to get from me. We don't have insurance to pay, and see if that'll help him get out of the case. And he did. I mean, the damages were probably like $30,000 or $40,000 in the case total, but there was also a lawsuit against the contractor and some other stuff. So he wrote him a check for $5,000. It was cheaper than paying me. It was cheaper than paying, I guess, his premiums over a number of years. That was his thought, but that's what he did. So I don't recommend that to anybody. It's just a quirky story that I had. Question.
I'm sorry. I know you already explained the question about licensing interior architects or landscape architects and contractors.
Yeah.
But I think I'm confused by the phrasing of the question. What do you mean by what about licensing?
Can you license an interior architect? Should you license interior architects to do interior architecture? Should you license landscape architects or landscape? Should you license contractors? We know that those individuals aren't necessarily going to be doing architecture as a licensed architect, but should those other types of services be licensed? And the answer in Illinois, and that's a great question because I don't think I was clear with that. The answer in Illinois is that for years, to be a contractor, you have to be a licensed contractor, licensed builder. That was always there. Landscape architects in certain states are required. And in Illinois, only recently, only in the last 10 or 15 years, did they create a licensure statute and exam for interior architects as opposed to interior designers. And they did that because they also wanted to protect their business. Question?
And so, interior architects, they get
a CIE. Right.
Do they
No, that's the specific. It's specific for the interior architectural, so it won't include the structural mechanics and the electrical and those things. So there are some things that they can do, but it's not as broad as an architectural and engineering license. Yes. Well, it depends if they're structural walls. So like there's a lot of sites like we did. When I was working for this interior firm, I was just in college, and I did a lot of stuff with that. It was a really fun job because they gave me a lot of freedom, and so I did a lot of design work on my own that never was looked at by the architect that was licensed in the shop because I was just moving like partition walls, nothing was structural and everything else. So I did reflective ceiling plans, but I didn't do the electrical runs and I didn't know what the wattage and everything else. I'm like, we're gonna have this curve light going here, and you know, like it was purely design. And stuff like that. I didn't ever sit for that. But interestingly enough, the interior architectural exam didn't exist when I got out and was practicing for the first number of years that I was practicing architecture. I don't even think when I first started teaching this class 14 years ago existed. I think it's only like 5 or 8 years old. And they did that, and I think it's wise, again, to get to regulate both their profession and for business commerce. Because now you have an interior architect versus a designer. So now we have yet one more. So you have the architect, the interior architect, and the designer that picks out your pillows and curtains and stuff like that. So, question?
You wanted to do interiors. Could you not be insured as an interior architect?
So now I'm a licensed architect, but my practice, I only want to do interior architecture.
So you have a fun project where you're just interior.
Which happens all the time. That happens all the time.
But because you're not a licensed interior architect, does the insurance that you might seek for that project not cover as much because you are not
So the architectural license you're going to have is broad enough that you don't have to take the interior licensing exam. So once you're a licensed architect, you can do everything that an interior architect does. It just doesn't go up, it just goes down. So you're going to be carrying what's called a practice policy. Every year you pay for your practice, so the insurance company's going to say, how many projects do you a year, what's your risk factor, blah, 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 they're going to create. So if you're an architect that mostly does architecture and occasionally does interior jobs, they're probably going to base your premiums and your policy on practicing architect. If you're a licensed architect and only do interior because now your risks are lower, they're going to put together your package based on your risk profile there. So there's all these things that go into what the insurance companies look at. But as an architect, you can do anything that an interior architect without taking that exam. Question? I don't remember what the initials stand for, but it's the... Yeah, it's National Design Institute of America Qualifications, maybe, NCIADQ. Yeah. So, In fact, I had a client years and years ago. She was did all interiors, and then she called me in a panic when she was like, "Oh my God, we have to take an exam now!" And I'm like, "It's okay." And we walked her through it. I didn't teach her anything, but really nice woman. It's their own license, yeah, when they created that. And there's a statute now for it and everything else. They basically lobbied and they said, well, if I can't get an architectural license because I don't have the degree, I want to be able to regulate my profession. I don't want to make it to hold out so I can hold out to people and tell people I'm a licensed interior architect. You can charge more too. Remember, if you have a profession and you have a license behind you, you can charge more. That helps too. Like, it's all, there's commerce is built into all that. I'm not trying to say it's only about money, but if I'm a licensed interior architect as opposed to interior designer, I should be able to get paid more money because I qualified. The state gave me a regulation. It may not be that I'm a better designer than the person down the street, but at least I can hold that out and say, I am a licensed interior architect. I took all the exams. You can trust me because the state trusts me. That's why you paid me a little bit more money. So, question?
I wonder if I work in the office and I'm not licensed, and I was doing the test, and I'm doing the test, maybe it's something wrong, like part of the design system. But I don't think I have enough skills to do it right. And then the company I'm working for is licensed and in trouble. Is there any contract or regulation that the company is CD, but they gave me the test? Is that fair to the company? Or they can legally sue me for not being able to?
So the lawsuit, which is going to be based on if there was a negligent action by you, let's say you designed something, it was negligent, the wall falls down. You're an employee of the company. As long, per Illinois, you're not in contract with the clients. The company should be in contract with the client. So the only lawsuit could be against the company. So they sue the company. The company has to pay $1 million. Can the company sue you as their employee? They're effectively suing themselves. And so that normally doesn't happen unless you defrauded them. That may be that they look bad because they left you somebody that there was a complicated project and they left you alone. So it's not something that they would normally do. Can they fire you? But they probably aren't going to sue you. I can't say that that's in every situation because there's plenty of employees that defraud their company or lie and cheat and steal and they get sued by their own company. But if you're just doing your best and they gave you something that was over your head and it's not your fault or even you tried your best, and I think you would have at least some type of action or defense against them if they tried to say you stepped outside of your bounds or what have you. But they, like I said, they may let you go. But that's different than being sued. So you wouldn't be. I would never think you'd like say. Let's say there's $1 million settlement or a judgment or whatever. You would. I can't ever see you being on hook for that. That's the company because the company's in contract with the individual that was injured. So. And the last question: why prohibit the recovery fees for practicing without a license, especially if it's licensed elsewhere? And we talked about that. It's just about commerce and regulation more than anything else. That's why this company, like, they want to make sure that we're in Illinois, we're licensed in Illinois. So. Okay, let's move to forms of agency. Wait, before we go on, any questions more on licensing? I gotta say, and I'm so happy, although to keep you guys here a little longer, I'm not telling you guys to start to slow down or that stuff. This is like the best discussion I've had in 14 years about licensing and architecture, so you guys are awesome. I really appreciate the questions. So, okay, forms of agency. So we have the law of agency. Now we're going to go back to a little legal stuff. Okay, there are three parties in an agency. There's the agent, there's the principal, and then there's the third party. So what do we have here? The agent is a person acting on behalf of another. That's what the agent is. The other that they're acting on behalf of is the principal. And the third party is the person with whom the agent is interacting on behalf of the principal. Got that? Let me give you a couple examples of what you would see in common agency relationships. Employer-employee. So if you are designing that house where the wall fell down, you're talking to the client, but you are an employee of the company, maybe you're even an owner of the company, you are acting as an agent of the company. And the company, depending on where you are, the company is the one that's responsible for everything, but depending on what your authority is, and we'll get that in the next slide, you would be the agent, and things you say are held responsible, that the company is responsible for that because you're an agent. An actor with their like an actor or an athlete, they're agents. You know, like we always hear about baseball and hockey and or sports or like actors and actresses and everything else. They always have an agent. That Hollywood agent. In fact, my sister's in She's in the movie industry. Have you guys seen any of the Final Destination movies? She's the producer. She's produced all six of those. And they were supposed to have this most recent one, Bloodlines, was supposed to be the end of the movie, but they made so much money on it that they're going to do, they're right now writing Final Destination 7, so there's another one coming out. But she was up there when that whole, like, have you seen, how many people seen Bloodlines? Have you seen Bloodlines, the last one? All right, at least you know the movies. But there's a scene in Bloodlines where it looks like there's a building on the top. It looks like the Seattle Space Needle. And then because of like all the stuff that happens, it starts to tip and fall, and people fall out and die and everything else. And they actually built this giant, it wasn't CGI or anything else, they built this giant restaurant that was a circle, and they put it on all these gimbals. And so when people are sliding, and the piano's sliding, and walls are crashing and things, that was all filmed live, one shot. It was like this. I think it was over $1 million that they do to build this whole thing, and people slide out, and she was up there when they filmed it. But she has an agent when she goes from movies to movies, or athletes, or when she goes and wants to, or not athletes, but actors, when she hires the actors that are in the Final Destination movies, she deals with their agents. She doesn't call up, you know, the actor and say, you're going to be in this movie. She calls up the agents, and the people, you know, they apply, or they do their audition for the movies and stuff like that. Real estate broker, a property owner. When you sell your house, you can sell for sale by owner, but a lot of people get a real estate agent because they have a better distribution. They know how to work the advertising and get the name out and everything else. So that's another one where we have an agency. And then an owner or architect, but I have here to a limited extent. I had to bring it back to why is it important here. When we talk about the B-101 in a couple of weeks, you're going to see there's language in the B-101 contract that says the architect is acting as an agent of the owner only where it's specifically stated in the contract. So there are times you are the owner's agent during a project, but it's very limited. But in fact, it says, architect has the authority on behalf of the owner to do X, Y, and Z. In that instance, when the paragraph in the contract says that they are as an agent of the owner, speaking with the third party. And as a result of being an agent of the owner, and when the next slide will show, is that your words as the agent are imputed to the principal. Questions on that? Okay. Purpose and theory. Why do we have an agent? Often agents have a greater experience than their principals. Like, I'm a Detroit Tigers fan. They have a pitcher who's won the Cy Young Award for the last 2 years in a row named Tarek Skubal. Tarek Skubal will probably be the next $400 million baseball player when he signs his next contract next year. He's been asked a million times about his next contract. Is he going to stay with the Tigers? Is he going somewhere else and everything else? And he's like, I leave the business stuff to my agents. The agents know how to work the system much better than that. He's like, I'm a pitcher. So I hire an agent who knows the people and the position, the process, and everything else. Most often it's a lawyer when you get in a high-level area, but not always. I have a good friend from way back when I was a child, and he is now a big agent. And you guys remember Sean White, the snowboarder? He represented Sean White. He did all the deals with Sean White when they did the video companies, and so he does a lot of hockey players, a lot of winter sports, and he does both athlete contracts. He does deals with their advertisers and their, you know, when they do promotions and everything else, and then he actually gets them their names on the video games and stuff. He's an agent because he knows all the business. Sean White's just out there having a great time. Principals may delegate tasks. You can't be everywhere all the time. If you have lots of stuff going on, or maybe you want to remain anonymous. You know, if you think about it like at an auction, they always have the anonymous bidder, and there's somebody in the back that's holding the paddle up. And then certain legal entities can only operate through agents. A corporation, which we'll find out a little bit later, a corporation is created as a business entity. But what's a corporation? A corporation is made up of a bunch of shareholders. So who is speaking on behalf of the corporation? If there's officers and directors, those entities, those individuals, are not, they may be owners because they're shareholders too, but they are the agents for the corporation. So as a legal entity, the only way a corporation can speak is through an agent, an officer or director. Effects of the agency relationship. The agency binds the principal to an agreement or contract. So if I sign or I have the authority, I am binding the principal. I'm not responsible as the agent. I don't have to pay that $200,000 when I go and purchase a really cool car on behalf of my principal. The principal has to. sign the thing, give me that exquisite, you know, collector's car. I sign the contract as the agent, but I don't have to write the check. It's the principal. Knowledge of the agent is attributed to the principal, even if the principal doesn't have such knowledge. Remember the slider up here, it says the agency may have greater expertise. So when there's information being set forth by the agent about stuff that's very complicated because they're a specialist in that area, that knowledge base is to the principal. And so when the principal comes back, let's say something goes south with the deal, and the principal comes back and says, well, I didn't know that. I didn't understand that. Nobody told me that. The other side says, but your agent knew it, and the agent understood that, and you are attributed to having that knowledge. So you need to go have a discussion with your principal, your agent. Why didn't they tell you all this information? I don't care that you didn't know. You told me your agent was had the authority to do this. You're stuck with it. So, if you're ever in a situation where you're the architect and you're acting as an agent for your client, the owner, make sure there's a good level of communication before you promise things on behalf of the owner. Question?
So, in the case of that situation, the agent is going to say, well, I'm going to be the principal, and it's going to be the architect?
For the owner. The agent is the architect for the owner. The third party could be the contractor. It could be a subcontractor. It could be the village when you're getting a building permit. If anybody besides the owner and the architect. So the architect is the agent, the owner is the principal, and it's anybody else that the agent is speaking to on behalf of the owner. Okay? Any questions? More questions than that? All right. Agent's duties to the principal. So you have fiduciary duties. You owe. So while you're going to be speaking on behalf of them, and while you are, everything you say is imputed to the owner, you as an agent still have duties. You have a duty of loyalty. There's no double dealing. If the owner says, I need you to do this, this, and this, you can't start doing your own stuff. You have to have loyalty to the instructions and everything else. You can't confide information to other people because you might think it gets the deal done. Because you have loyalty to the owner. Care. You can't be negligent. You just don't want to start going flying off the handle and everything else. You have a duty of care to the owner or the principal in this situation. Obedience. If you were given instructions, do not bid on that antique car more than $200,000. If you bid $210,000, you violated that. The owner could say, I'm not buying it at all. And then the authority, we get into the question of impaired authority, we'll get there in a second, who's going to be responsible for it? Maybe the owner's responsible for 200 and the agent's only responsible for 10. Maybe the owner's only responsible for 0 and the agent's responsible for 210. I don't know how that would work out, depending on how the thing is, but the agent must do what the owner has asked them to do and can't go beyond those stakes. And then finally, notification. The agent, must tell them what happened. That way the owner doesn't come back and say, or the principal, I keep saying owner, but the principal comes back and says, I didn't know this, I didn't know I did this, I didn't know this. Doesn't matter, as we said, because all that knowledge and information that the agent has stated is imputed to the owner. So you must, as an agent, tell the principal what happened. And if you fail to do that, you may have liabilities. So any violation of these four duties by an agent could put the agent at risk of damages, whether it's damages to the principal, damage to the third party because the promise never came through, the $200,000, $210,000 never came for the car, whatever it might be. As long as the agent has followed these four rules, they should be okay, but if they violate these four rules, there's an exposure to the agent. Questions on that? Yes? Fiduciary is financial. Fiduciary duty is a financial duty, because most of the time in an agency relationship with contracts, you're going to be dealing with, there are going to be contracts for performance of services, but there's always, like even an actor, I promised the actor's going to do this movie, but there's still going to be a monetary element to it, so your fiduciary it's not only financial, but it has to do transactionally, but by and large you can think of it as financially, okay? Okay. Source of the agent's authority. So because they have the authority to speak on behalf of the principal, where does that come from? There's actual authority. The actual authority is explicitly granted. The principal tells the agents, you can do this, you must do that, do not do this. That's express actual authority. It can be written, it can be oral, or it can be implied. Now implied, you get like, what does that mean, implied? Well, I have a real estate agent. They're not going to be out there selling my boat. They're going to be selling my house. There's some things that by nature, the friend of mine that's the agent for Sean White and others out in Colorado, he's known in the industry of the areas where he negotiates, and so he's the one that is implied that when he goes into a contract negotiation on behalf of Sean White or whomever else, he's going to talk to them about money and deals and parameters and everything else. So there's some implied authority that Sean, because Sean's not going to say, Kurt, I need you to do this, 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 and this. There may be three or four things in there, but it's not everything. Here's another thing you hear from time to time. Take like rock stars or bands or whatever. You hear that they have to have certain things in their dressing room, like certain kind of candies or certain types of flowers or whatever. The agent sets that all up. Those are the quirky things that are going to be the actual things where the drummer's like, yeah, we've got to have this in there. We've got to make sure we only have Belvedere vodka or whatever it might be. That's something that would be expressed. But there's all this other stuff that's implied authority that the agent's going to make sure these other things are there. So that's, but they know that. Everybody knows that actual authority. So that's the first kind. Second is apparent authority. Apparent authority is where the principal, it's got to come from the principal, leads the third party to believe that this authority is granted to the agent. So I have an owner's rep. I'm an owner, and we're building a strip mall. And but I got all these businesses going on, so I hire an owner's rep. The owner's rep is the one that's going to be speaking on my behalf. I told my owner's rep that they can do A, B, and C, but I tell the contractor, oh, Sarah, she speaks for me. Just Sarah will take care of it. I like working with her. She's going to do everything. She speaks to me. That is apparent authority to the third party, the contractor, that Sarah has all authority. So it's authority that leaves the third parties to believe. The third party never saw the list of what Sarah can do, and Sarah could violate that list. Let's say I gave Sarah a list as the principal of five things that she can do and five things she can't. If she violates the can and does two or three of those things, to me, she's violated our rules. She's violated the rule of obedience and loyalty and care, probably. But the other side doesn't know that because I said, hey, Sarah speaks for me. And so the other side can say there's a deal, and I am stuck with it because I didn't make it clear to what Sarah can really do to the third party. But now I have a potential action between Sarah and me because she violated our own internal rules. So apparent authority, it must be the principal. The agent can't say, oh, Sarah, oh, the owner said, the principal said I can do whatever I want. No, it has to come from the principal. Apparent authority only comes from the principal. And then the last one, where the source of authority is called ratification. So let's say ratification, not all actions are binding on the agent. So there could be when the agent, Sarah in this case, has stepped over her skis and she's done too much stuff. And the contractor didn't have the apparent authority. The contractor was never told, oh, Sarah can do whatever I want. But the deal gets done and Sarah has done these couple things that are outside of it. Traditionally, if I, as the principal, comes back and says, I'm not going to do X and Y because Sarah didn't have the authority, nor did I tell you she had the authority to do X and Y, so there's no deal, that's fine, then the deal's not done. But if I go ahead with the deal and I proceed forward and then we're all good and everything else and something happens, my actions, if there's something that happens with X and Y, I never reject it, I never say no, that couldn't happen, I know about X and Y, and I proceed with the deal, by my acceptance, that's ratification. I'm actually ratifying and saying, even though I didn't expressly or implicitly or apparently give Sarah the authority to do X and Y, by my actions as the principal, I have accepted that. I've adopted that. by ratifying it. Ratification always happens after the fact. You don't ratify beforehand because that would either be express or apparent authority. Ratification always happens afterwards. And it can be express or it can be implied. I could say to the contractor as the principal, yeah, you know, Sarah didn't really have the authority to negotiate X and Y on behalf, but you know, I'm okay with it, so we're good. That's an express ratification. Or like I said, I set the deal, I know that X and Y are in the terms and conditions, I sign the deal, that's an implied acceptance. Question over there.
Can an agent actions like implicitly ratify an agreement, or is that like because the principal's position in this relationship, they're the ones who like?
So the agent's actions can never ratify. The only entity that can ratify a portion that was not given the authority. Think of it this way. Ratification comes when the agent does something to which they didn't have the authority. So Sarah never had the authority to negotiate X and Y. I didn't tell the contractor what Sarah's boundaries were. I also didn't tell the contractor that Sarah could do whatever she wanted. So I didn't give any express knowledge to the contractor, nor did I give any apparent knowledge to the contractor. So the contractor accepts the deal, including the X and Y, believing that Sarah can say everything, but doesn't have the ability to say, well, you gave me apparent authority, okay? That's how the deal gets set up. X and Y was beyond any agency or any authority that Sarah had. The only person, the only entity that can ratify that, meaning accept that X and Y, is the principal. Because I'm the only one that can give Sarah the authority to do A, B, and C, and X and Y. I've already given her A, B, and C. I'm stuck with that no matter what it is, because she had the express authority. I told Sarah, go do A, B, and C. But she did X and Y. If I say to the contractor, I know Sarah couldn't do X and Y, I'm going to accept it. I've now ratified and given agency or authority to Sarah to have negotiated on my behalf. Or if, having seen the term sheet, I see X and Y in there and I still sign on the dotted line as the principal, that's implied ratification. So it's only by the principal that can ratify. It only comes after the fact, and it's only ratifying elements to which the agent did not have the authority to do that. Make sense? Okay. Undisclosed principal. So there's times when we don't know who the principal is. An agent could pretend to be acting on his or her own behalf, but the agent is really acting on behalf of an undisclosed principal. That can happen. Someone can show up to a deal and negotiate and never tell you that they have some secret benefactor behind them on whom they're negotiating with. As long as the authority to do all that negotiation has been granted by the principal to the agent, you do not have to tell the other side who the principal is. It's an undisclosed agent. Now, or it's a principal. Now, the interesting thing is so I'm a contractor, we'll just keep it in architecture, and I'm a contractor, and I enter into a contract with an owner who I believe is going to be building this building. Well, it turns out that the entity with whom I'm dealing with, I'm talking about, isn't really the owner, and I don't know that because it's a corporation that I'm going to enter into with this deal. I don't know who all these people are. So send the contract. Can I, as the contractor, if something goes wrong, can I sue the person with whom I thought I had a deal? If it's undisclosed, well, you would sue whomever you entered into the contract with, and maybe at that point in time, you would then learn through discovery or otherwise that there's this secret benefactor behind. But normally, you wouldn't be able to bring the action against the agent because there's an undisclosed principal. Now, it doesn't happen very often, but there are times when that happens, where the third party does not know that they're really acting, that there's somebody behind the scenes. What you're more going to have is that the second part here, the agent indicates there's a principal but fails or refuses to provide the identity of the principal. And like I said, the example I have is at art auctions, there's always that person that wants to get that rare, whatever it might be, but they don't want to show up, they don't want anybody to know about their collection, who's got the money. You know, you hear about these, just the stuff that goes at Sotheby's or some of these other auction houses. Most of the time when you're reading about people that are paying millions and millions of dollars for these things, most of the time they're acting through a principal, I'm sorry, through an agent, and the principal is the one that is behind the scenes. I just read yesterday that Scottie Pippen, he's a basketball player for the Bulls, he's putting his entire memorabilia, everything he ever got, out for up for auctions. It's going to go up at auction in March. It's going to have like these mini, they're made out of silver but gold plated mini championship trophies, all six of them he's putting out there, all of his jerseys, all of his medals from the Olympics and everything else. I don't know why, maybe he doesn't want it anymore, maybe he doesn't need money or whatever. I guarantee there are going to be people bidding on Scottie Pippen's stuff that have an agent there, and we don't know who's bidding on it because maybe they're just big memorabilia fans but they don't want people to know who they are. So, third party may have a claim against both the agent and the principal if there's this refusal. If they know there's somebody behind, they say, no, I'm not going to tell you who it is. They may not. It just depends on what the situation is and what was in the mind of the third party. How much information did they have or not? Can they claim against the agent? There's an argument that says the third party does have a right to know with whom it's dealing. So you could have that secret one behind. That's this first one here, and even when you just have the anonymous one. What you're going to find in many situations, though, is especially if it's put into like an auction house, if something's going to go into an auction house, they will allow, per their rules of the auction, to have anonymous bidders. And so the person, in this case, since Scottie Pippen's stuff is going to go up through an auction house, the only way he is able to auction his stuff off through, I can't remember, Sotheby's or whoever it is, he must abide by their rules, because they're the professionals that are going to do it. They're going to be an agent for him in auctioning it off. And their rules say we can have anonymous bidders. And so they have separate rules. But if it's just, I'm dealing with somebody straight up, and then there's an agent, there's somebody behind me, I can ask. And then if they don't give me that information, potentially I could have an action against them. Question on that? There will be a question on agency in the exam. One or two questions on agency, just so you know. How do we get rid of an agency relationship? How do we terminate? You know, at some point in time, it's got to end. Express or imply termination. Express. Thank you for your services, but I don't need them anymore. You're no longer my agent. When we were selling my condo, we had a condo, my wife and I, that I used to rent out. And we had a real estate agent, wonderful woman that I've worked with for many years. And she came back and was very kind. Her business had expanded and she was dealing with huge business buildings and everything else. She was not in the condo business anymore, but I had used her when I first bought the condo. So she was out there marketing our place. And because it was small potatoes for her. And she had bigger things. So she really did a good job in marketing it out. We called her up and said, I'm like, I love you. I've worked with you for many years. I really appreciate all your help. You're not my real estate agent anymore. I especially told her the agency's over with. It was fine. It was a good separation because I'd known her for years and she had better business. But expressly ended the agency relationship. Imply. Same concept in real estate. Once your house is sold, it's implied that the agent has finished their services and they're done. So the agency relationship is terminated. When you negotiate a contract, that agency relationship is terminated. So you finish your job. That's implied that the agency relationship has been done or separated. Those are two ways that you can see that done. At the end of a given period of time, maybe sometimes it says you're my agent for only so many months. There's an actual span in the deal that you set together. Or when the purpose is accomplished, that's what I just said as far as they sold the house, they cut the deal on the movie or whatever it might be. But the principal at any time, that's what I did, I called up my real estate agent and I said, it's done. But the termination could be a breach of the agency relationship because there is a contract created between the principal and the agent. And if that contract says you're my agent for X number of months and I get rid of you before those number of months, or you're my agent and sole authority on this, and I go find somebody else, and like I like them better, and I come back. Well, I had a deal. So there may be terms of the contract, the principal agency relationship, there may be terms that when I, as the agent, says you're fired, maybe I didn't have the right to do that. That would come down to the terms of the agreement, the understanding between the parties, the contract. Is it a breach of contract? So, and you'll find some people, like especially in the entertainment and the sports world and everything else, people, their livelihood is based around representing exclusively these athletes and these actors and people that are to whom they have high bargaining power. And so the agency contracts are that between actor and agent or athlete and agent are very specific about how termination happens and how this and that. And many times it's the party that has the strongest rights to terminate is not the principal, or not the agent, but in fact it's the principal. The principal, like the athlete, and says, I can walk away, but the agent can never say I can walk away. So, but the principal, so most of the time it's the principal that's going to terminate it. There can be violations. Let's say you're not getting paid by, the agent's not getting paid for their work. Maybe that's a breach of contract and the agent can terminate. So there's different ways you can do it. Questions on that? Okay. Oh, one last thing. The principal should advise, oh, this is really important. I'm glad I didn't get this one. The principal should advise all third parties of the termination to avoid apparent authority. Let's say I have Sarah out there negotiating this contract on my behalf, and Sarah has gone into X and Y and came back and reported to me during the negotiations, but before I sign, oh, X and Y are down on the table. And I'm like, we're not doing X and Y. We never had that. Sarah, I don't like that. We're going to end this relationship. You have violated one of your fiduciary duties of obedience. You are no longer my agent. I have taken away any authority for you to negotiate the deal. And Sarah shows up at the negotiations the next day and cuts the deal without X and Y. Cuts the deal with A, B, and C. Well, if I haven't told the third party that Sarah has no authority to speak on behalf, if I have not disclosed, the other side doesn't know, so even though I've fired Sarah, the other side looks at it as apparent authority because Sarah has been sitting at that table for the last 2 weeks. And so when that deal is cut, the third party is going to impose it against me because they believe that she had both express and, in this case, apparent authority because I didn't tell them. So if there's a severing of the relationship, whether it's agent fires principal or principal fires agent, the principal has an obligation to inform the third party that there is no longer a relationship or they could be bound to the deal. Okay? All right. Any questions more on agency? Yes? Technically, yes. I love to say, I mean, the reason I'm thinking about it is because I actually put this in an email last night to somebody I was talking about. I was just telling them a story. Like when we get rid of a client, so we as a lawyer are the agent of the client on behalf of a negotiation or on behalf of their litigation. We are acting as their agent. That's an agency relationship. And we send out a letter to the client that says, here's what we're going to be doing for you, here's my billable rates, here's this, here's that, blah, blah, blah. Sort of establishes that an engagement letter and establishes the contract between us lawyers as the agent of the principal, the party whom we're defending or prosecuting or negotiating contract, so we establish that relationship. Let's say that the principal, and this has happened to me, unfortunately, from time to time, happens to every lawyer, or maybe not every lawyer, but many lawyers, the principal doesn't want to pay me. For whatever reason. Maybe they don't have the money. Maybe they don't like the fact that they lost. Maybe they don't like the fact that I'm more expensive than them and they don't want to pay. And you go back and you try to negotiate and you talk to them. And by the way, it doesn't happen just in law. Like, you're going to have clients probably, you're here with firms that where the architect, they don't want to pay the architect. Oh, we're not doing the deal anymore. We were going to build this house, but we're moving on. We're going to do something else. I don't have your drawings. I don't care. So I'm not going to pay you. And you're like, okay. We always, it's not technical, but I'm always like, we fired the client. We told them we're no longer going to represent them. You're out. So we as the agent said you're gone. It's truly a breach of contract. And so it's not like, and we are technically quitting on them. We're saying, I'm not doing your work anymore. But I always refer to it. That's why I stopped because I was only chuckling to myself internally. Like, I have fired a couple clients, not many in my career, but I've been doing this 35 years. So there's been a couple clients that I fired because they didn't pay me. And they didn't feel that they needed to pay me. And I'm like, okay, then I'm not representing you. And they're like, well, wait a minute. No, I wonder about it. I'm like, no, you don't pay me. I've given you all these times. You're fired. I didn't say that to them, but that's what we refer to it. So technically, you're right. I'm quitting on working with them because they breached the contract. And if they come back and try to sue me and say I must be their lawyer, I'm going to countersue and say you breached the contract because you didn't pay me. So we'll get into the contractual reveal of what that engagement letter said. So we'll get like technically legal. So it really won't be a firing or quitting. It'll be a breach of contract. And so if it's a breach of contract, the deal is now done. So, but good question. The reason why I paused is because I was laughing because I'm like, yeah, I fired a couple clients before. You don't like doing that because then you have to eat the money. You don't get the money. But it happens sometimes. Sometimes you just have bad clients. That's just, you know, whatever. Not everybody is as honest as we'd like them to be. Okay, any more questions on agency? All right. Forms of association. First one we got up, sole proprietorship. Any individual that conducts a business is sole proprietorship. So when my daughter did do her lemonade stand down the corner of the street, which she did do once, like twice ever in her life, but she did, she was a sole proprietorship. There is no legal distinction between the business and the individual. This is probably one of the most important things that you need to remember about a sole proprietorship. A lot of people like to say, I just want to do my own thing. Like I'm gonna be a freelance writer, and so I'm just gonna do my own thing. I'm gonna get my own tax identification number, and I'm gonna send out bills and everything else. I'm just hanging my shingle. That's all I'm gonna do. That's a sole proprietorship. The problem is, the good part is the income is treated as personal income. So when I get a check, it's just like I got a check before from my former employee. It would just come in, it goes into my bank account, it's mine, it's no big deal. And the IRS looks at it and it's just, you got a check. But there are no liability protections because there's no distinction between individual and business. So if my daughter had problems with her lemonade stand and she got in a lawsuit, they could take her house, or her Barbie's house or whatever. Like, you can't protect your personal stuff if you're a sole proprietorship. That's one of the biggest risks. You have to, if you don't separate it, everything that's yours could be someone else's if you breached the contract or violated the negligence. Question?
In what we were talking about earlier, in a sole proprietorship, would you still need to license the business?
So if you are a sole proprietorship and you don't represent yourself other than I'm Mike Hanahan, I'm your architect, and I sign the contract as Mike Hanahan, not Mike Hanahan Architects, whatever. No, you don't need to be that. But you have to be registered as a business in the state, so you still have to register yourself as a sole proprietorship. And then it gets into some quirky things. But yeah, you could do that. It's not recommended. But there are plenty of sole proprietorships. I mean, my sister is a jewelry designer. She's been doing it for 25 years out in California. And she finally, after a number of times that her younger brother told her, I'm like, would you just incorporate yourself and get yourself an LLC? I'm like, I know nobody's going to sue you because like the earring dangled wrong, but like, protect yourself. You never know what's going to happen. Like, so she's an LLC now. But as a sole proprietorship, you can practice architecture as just yourself. You're entering into the agreement as just an architect doing that thing. So, okay. You can use assumed name. So you can say it's a different name, but as long as you are stating that it's just you, you're not registered. So you can do DBA. It says, you know, blah, 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 DBA. That's where another thing, so that you don't have to put your name only as Mike Hanahan out there any other time. You could have whatever the name of your company is, but again, you're exposed. And the other interesting thing is with a sole proprietorship, you can also have employees. You don't have to just be the only person working. In fact, my accountant, he was like, because my wife has her own business. She's an LLC now, but originally she wasn't herself because she was just a freelance writer and stuff. And my accountant was like, how old are your kids? This is a number years back. I'm like, well, my son, I think he was like 13 or 14. He's like, you should have your wife hire your son, and then she can get a tax write-off that he'd be employee of your wife's sole proprietorship. And I'm like, okay, we're not doing that. It was much too complex. I'm like, and who knows if my 13-year-old kid would do anything for him, but he's a good kid, but he was 13. But yes, you can have employees as a sole proprietorship. It's not just only one person. So, okay, that's it. That's all you need to know about sole proprietorships. Partnerships. A partnership is like a sole proprietorship, but there's now another person or more. So you are joined together as a partnership. You can have 2 people, 3 people, 10 people, 100 people, whatever you want to do. You can have a partnership, and it's treated by the government, again, as like a sole proprietorship. Whereas if it's just a pure partnership, then you may be in trouble because personal assets could be exposed. Let's say there's 2 people, me and Bob. Bob and I are in a business together, and everything is split equally between Bob and I. Everything's good. And then Bob screws up. Bob, let's say Bob's a screw-up and he's been screwing up all his life and he really has no money or anything else. Because we're a partnership, not only could the person that he harmed come after Bob, he can come after me and my personal assets as a pure partnership. So it's treated liability like a sole proprietorship, and you can go after the partner. Now, there are some stuff that govern partnerships in Illinois. There's the Uniform Partnership Act, which creates a default agreement. It has in the Uniform Partnership Act the rules by which you should be operating as a partnership. Even if you don't create agreements, it creates the terms of the agreements for you under the Uniform Partnership Act. There's court-created law. When stuff goes down in partnerships and people sue each other or they sue the partnership, there's lots of case law out there. So the law by your, back to our hierarchy, court law, case law, that's what regulates the partnership and what's going to happen with who's responsible, who's liable, and who gets profits and everything else. There'll be a partnership agreement. That's something that if you're ever going to get into a partnership, I would highly recommend you enter into a document there online to make sure you have a partnership agreement so everybody understands. Let's say we start a company and I am the brains and Bob is the money. So Bob funds the company and I do the design work. And we are a partnership and we do an architectural firm. I'm licensed, so it's 50%, so we can be a licensed partnership. Bob is funding the company because he wants to develop and blah, blah, blah. And then it turns out at the end of the first year we have a profit of $500,000. Who gets the profit and how's it split? Bob's going to be like, I put in all the money for this company, so I should get all of it, or I should get 90% of it, or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm the brains. Without me, there wouldn't be any design, so whatever. So you want to have a partnership agreement that says profits 50-50, 60-40, 70-30, whatever that deal is. And then the same thing is when we get sued and we get hit for a judgment for $500,000, Bob's going to be like, I didn't draw that drawing. I should have no liability. It's your fault. You did that. You did a crappy drawing. The wall fell down. I get no liability. You have all the liability. So not only does your partnership agreement say, how do you share the profits? It also says, how do you share the liabilities? That's probably coming up on the next slide, but that's something you want to put in your partnership agreement. Debt and taxes. Individual partners are responsible for the debt of the entire partnership. So if something goes wrong, all for one, one for all. We all have to we're all in the boat together. And then profits or losses are taxed at a pro rata to the partner's interest. So if we get $500,000 in, and I have, let's make it $100,000 so I don't have to do backwards math. So we get $100,000 profit, and I have 70% of the equities that I get. I will be taxed at $70,000, and Bob will be taxed at $30,000, because it's a 70-30 split. But if there's a loss, and let's say the losses are 50-50, then I can take half of the losses of the company and apply that to profits, and so the company's going to, they don't need to be the same. So when the taxes are looked at, they're going to take a look and they're going to say, what's your percentage of profitability? What's your percentage of losses? How are those then equated? And that'll be for your tax purposes. There will be no tax questions on the exam. I just wanted to tell you that's kind of how it's done, but that's something that you can just, if you're ever in a partnership. So, the divisions between the parties. The rights and the duties may be divided by an agreed percentage. As I said, 70-30, 60-40, 50-50, whatever it is. And partners are not guaranteed a salary per month. The second one talks about the different profits. And you can have, second point is, you can have 75% of losses of the profits, but only 33% of losses. It just depends on what the deal is. It's an agreement like anything else. And then partners are not guaranteed a salary. traditional partners, a true partnership, you're not being paid a salary. If you're being paid a salary, you're an employee. A true partnership is how much profit does the company make. Now, some partnerships close their books every month so they can get a paycheck every month. Some partnerships close their books every quarter, every half year, or a year. That is to determine the profitability of the partnership. But what do you do if your company only closes their books once a year and you don't look at what your profits are? How do you get paid during January, February, March, April? Well, maybe the partnership agreement says you get a draw against the eventual profits. So we're going to give you $10,000 a month, believing that at the end of the year, we will have made enough profit that you would have gotten $120,000. If we get more, you'll get more money. So you can draw against that. Again, that's going to be in the partnership agreement. But ultimately, that draw is not a salary. It's not guaranteed. The money in the partnership is really only based on what profits that partnership can get. And again, this is like partnership 101. There's very different levels of partnerships and how you can draw against it. And sometimes there's you're borrowing against companies. And all, we won't even get into any of that. You can borrow against interests and assets. Like, let's say I get a job. I know it's going to be paying in 2027. I'm going to be getting $1 million from this job, but I'm only going to get $200,000 in 2027. Maybe I can draw against that coming in so I get more money in 2026. There's lots of things. You don't have to worry about any of that. Just know that really the money that comes to the partners is based on the profitability ultimately. Each partner is an agent of each other. We go through agency, and they're an agent of the partnership. So they're speaking on behalf of each other, and everything one or both or all of the partners say binds the partnership. So you as a partner have the full authority to act or bind the partnership. If we go back to that lawyer that I told you about that never was graduated from law school and never licensed, and he made partner, since he was never technically allowed to make partner, that's why the firm thought they were in trouble. But because another partner was involved in every one of his cases, I believe it was every one of the cases, that other partner was able to bind the partnership to that they had operating properly and within the license and everything else. So you are binding as a partner the partnership and the individuals. Any knowledge from one partner is fully attributable to the partnerships, like we talked about before. So that's why that extra lawyer on it said, well, it's okay because I knew what he knew what I knew, so we were okay. And the partnership duties are similar to agency duties, but they operate in a two-way direction, meaning an agent has duties to the principal, loyalty, obedience, care, and I shouldn't remember the fourth one. Loyalty, obedience, care. It's on a slide. I'll remember it. Agent has duties to the principal, but the principal, other than fraud or something like that, doesn't owe much to the agent, pay their bills or what have you. But in a partnership, it goes two ways. Everything I say binds the other one, and everything they say binds me, back and forth, no matter what. There are duties of loyalty to each other, duties of obedience to each other, duties of care to each other. Those are, without a doubt, back and forth, two-way. Effect of a partnership. Financially, the income is treated just as personal income, just like in a sole proprietorship. It's just like money coming into you. And there are also no special liability protections. You can sue me, you can get my house, you can get my car, and you get my partner's house and their car, and my other partner's house and their car, depending on what it is. So you don't have any protections for that. Not the best. Now, we have what's also in Illinois and other states called a limited partnership. Limited partnership actually is, again, controlled by the state. It's different than a partnership. A limited partnership principally is a financing mechanism. You're going to hear, like, LLPs, limited liability partnerships, or limited partnerships, and it's how you finance. And before they had LLCs, which we'll talk about in a second, people did limited partnerships. So in a limited partnership, you have the limited partner and then the general partner. Okay, general partner is what everybody sees, and the limited partner, all the guys behind, the men and women behind with the money. So the general partner is the same as a regular partnership. They're out talking, they're making deals on behalf of the partnership. It can be one individual, it could be many individuals. Those are the general partners, and they're acting like a regular partnership. The limited partners, they don't have any authority to make the deals with a third party. They're telling the general parties, though, what to do, general partnership, what to do. They're always going to be telling the generals, because the limited parties are the ones with the monies, but they want to be kind of behind the scenes. A lot of people that are financially well off, they create limited partnerships to finance deals, and then they aren't up here, but they put the money in, and then their partnership, their limited partnership agreement shows that they get all the money when it's all done. So they can't bind it. Limited partners can't bind them. And they're only liable to the extent of their individual financial contributions. So if I put in $1 million to a company and the company gets hit for $40 million, as a limited partner, I'm only responsible for that $1 million that I put in, unless there's something different in the deal. So, any questions on that? Corporations. Corporations, you guys may know this or not, are legal entities. They're just like people. But remember we were talking about an agency. I said there can be an entity that must have an agent that can speak on behalf of that legal entity. Well, corporations treated like a person, but a corporation is a body of things. So they can't speak on behalf because they're not truly an individual person. So they need their agents, officers, directors, shareholders, to speak on behalf. So, but they're people, as far as the government and as far as the law is concerned. They're governed by state law, the Illinois Business Corporation Act. You would have articles of incorporation you would create. It's like a document that shows what you're going to do. And then shareholder agreements for a closely held corporation. That's like a private company, like a family-owned business may have a closely held corporation. So there'll be a shareholder agreement because, like, normally it's what's going to happen is the family members all own money. They own a special interest in that closely held corporation. You know, instead of like you just being a stockholder for Apple or Disney or whatever, closely held corporation, only certain people can own that stock. So, but it is a corporation. Rights of the owners in a corporation. The owners of a corporation are the shareholders. Now, you can be an officer and be a shareholder, so you're an owner, but it's only the only owners of the company are the shareholders. What are their rights? They can vote for directors, officers, directors, they can vote for those. They can get dividends. Now, not all companies get dividends, but they can get dividends, which is a certain amount of money paid out either quarterly or annually based on the profitability of the company. And liquidation rights upon the corporate dissolution. So if a company goes down and is broken up, but there's still value to that company, the shareholders can get their percentage of shares owned back to them. So it's just, you know, you own so many shares, you get so much percentage of the company. Pretty simple. Corporate hierarchy. The shareholders sit on the top because they're the owners. They get to do whatever they want. Not whatever they want, but they're the ones that make the decisions. Below that are directors. They are agents of the corporation, and they owe those fiduciary duties as an agent to the corporation. Now, what ends up happening is if any of you guys have ever owned stock, sometimes you'll get a ballot once a year that says voting for the people that are going to be on the board of directors, and you check the boxes. Or if you're silent, there's a recommendation, like we're recommending these five and these two we're not recommending, but they're still on the ballot. If you don't say anything, it automatically is that you're going with the recommendations. But you can check the boxes or whatever. You as a shareholder are voting for your directors of the corporation. But in that vote, you are then giving them authority as your agent. You're the principal owner. You're giving them the authority to act on behalf of the company and the best of the company. So you're basically, your vote says you can do what you need to do as a director of the company. So while they're at the top of the list, especially if it's a public corporation, you really don't have much ability to say anything about the direction of the company. Maybe more for a private family, closely held corp. It's really the directors that make the decision of running the business. Next below that is officers. And officers can be directors as well. Sometimes you're both. But like a director is the board of directors. And then you're going to have below that in the officers, president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, blah, blah, blah. All those people. They are going to be down below. They are to be acting. They, the officers, have both, are agents and have a fiduciary duty to the corporation as well as to the board of directors. So the board of directors mandates strategy and theory, and then the officers are the one that's implemented because they're running the business on a day-to-day basis. And then the bottom are employees. Employees can be, some employees of a corporation can be agents. It depends on the scope of their employment. So you may be a director of a department. You're not an officer necessarily. Director may not be considered, you know, your project lead or your something like that. It may not be considered an officer per se in the bylaws or what have you. But you can still speak because you're high enough up in the chain that you can still speak on behalf of that corporation, and you may be an agent for that. So let's say I'm a purchasing agent or purchasing the director of procurement in a company, and I'm going out and purchasing doors because we build buildings and we have to get doors. So I'm the one that signs the work order and signs the invoices. I'm not an officer of a company. I'm just the guy that does purchasing. But I have enough of a authority, I'm a limited authority, to buy doors, so I'm an agent in that sense. I have to respond to what the officers allow me to do, which is what the director set their mandate, which are voted in by the shareholders, but that's me, who's an employee only, but still can act as an agent in limited capacity. Make sense? Question?
When you get like those ballots for voting on directors or something, I'm just curious, are those people like people that the corporation already like reviewed through an application, or like how do they even get on the ballot and why would they be recommended or not recommended?
Great question. How do people get on the ballot? A lot of times people get on the ballot because of who they are and their name. And so you're going to get like, this is years ago, years and years ago, but like for a long time, oh my God, I just forgot his name. Al Gore, who ran for president. He was on the board of directors of Apple because he had been the vice president, so it was a big deal. If you ever look at the big, big corporations, they're going to have a lot of big names because it gives gravitas and everything else. So there are people that are asked to be on boards. I actually get emails from time to time from companies that their job is to place individuals for boards. So I got an email like a month and a half ago that says, we are blah, 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 blah. Our job is to create, to get qualified directors to be on boards of companies. Would you be interested in joining us to make recommendations? I was like, well, so you're not asking me, you just want me for recommendations. Like, if somebody asked me, I'd be like, yeah, because when you get on a board, a lot of times you get paid. I have a sister-in-law who's really incredible in financial businesses. She's on a half a dozen boards of companies across the country because she is really sharp and sophisticated. It's not like she's there every day, but she has fiduciary duties to all these companies. She gets paid for that. So some people get on because of their name. Some people get on because of their skill set. Some people get on because it's a small company and they need to create a board of directors. So there's all different ways. And then when you get that ballot, yes, those people, like I said, sometimes you'll see a ballot will have 10 names and they'll say, here's the recommended slate. That means that people within the corporation, maybe the existing board of directors, have approved this slate. So they're almost approving themselves. Or maybe there's two or three that are rotating off or whatever, but they'll give you the approved slate and the not approved slate. You can vote to whomever you want, but again, normally on those things, if you don't vote, your vote will be counted as a silent vote for the recommended. But so there's different ways that people get on. There's different ways that they're approved. And if anybody here is or somebody needing a construction lawyer that wants to be on a board, I'm happy to do it. So anyway, that's generally what happens. Okay. There is no personal liability, though, in corporate malfeasance. That's what's good. If an employee or an officer or a director or a shareholder screws up in something, you can't go after them personally. Why? Because the corporation is the person. By law, remember that first bullet. The corporation is treated like a person. They are a legal entity, and so when something goes wrong in a corporation, as opposed to a sole proprietorship or a partnership, you can only sue the company. That's a big deal. There's complex, though, because of this and how they created corporations and everything, there's complex, restricted tax and accounting treatments. And in fact, you get double taxation. Like, you may get income from a corporation. Let's say you're a shareholder with lots of shares and they create a dividend, and in 2025 you got $10,000 in your dividend. That's going to be taxed because the dividend is taxed at the corporate level because it's profit that the individual, the corporation, makes. So the government's going to tax that $10,000 right out of the box, and it's worth $7,200. And then you get that $10,000, but there's your own personal income because you got a dividend, and it's going to get taxed again. So that $10,000 is going to get taxed twice. It's not going to get taxed first at $10,000 and then at $7,200. It's just its value will go from $10,000 down even more. So you will have to pay taxes effectively twice on your dividends or profits that come in. And it doesn't matter whether you're... It's because the only people that get that money are shareholders. So officers, directors normally have shares as well. So they're going to get double taxed. So that's a... And it's a quagmire. It's very... And that's when you need an accountant, when you have to have... When you have owned stocks and a number of them and how the double taxation happens and everything else. The other protection you have with this liability thing is the concept of what's called piercing the corporate veil. Anybody heard that term before, piercing the corporate veil? So when you sue someone, or sue a corporation, maybe it's a small company, a construction firm, and they're a corporation, and they have no board, they have like two people on the board or one people on the board, because you don't have to have, it's whatever you want to have on the board. And there's a president and a vice president, and what's happening is they're lying and cheating and stealing all the time, but they as individuals are protected because it's only the corporation that you can sue, and the corporation is worth, you know, the desks and the computers, and there's no assets in the corporation. Now you're like, okay, I got screwed for $1 million, but there's nothing to go after. Well, you really want to go after the money that the owner has, or the president, and the board of directors, whoever they are, because they're taking all the money themselves, however they take it, and they're the ones that have all the money that this company has made profitability. But if you the only way you can go to them individually is what's called piercing the corporate veil. You have to go and show by certain actions, did the individual, was it lying, was there a sham, was the corporation just a shell? Did they lie to you that there was a fraud? Was there something that wasn't true? It's very, very difficult to get behind that corporate veil. The laws are really, really tight. But you can from time to time. If the individual is acting sometimes on behalf of the corporation and sometimes acting on their behalf and they start intermingling funds, so instead of the money coming in going from a job going into the corporate fund to which then the principal, or the, not the principal, but the president then takes a salary, if the money just comes directly to the president, so now we have bank accounts that are commingling funds and things like that, you potentially can pierce the corporate veil and go after the president. But it's very difficult. That's a good protection on corporations, but there's the double tax. Did you have a question? Okay, sorry. One other type of corporation that is not as much, that you see as much, but it was in vogue and much more, certainly in Illinois in the 70s and 80s, something called a professional corporation. We've talked a few times today, accountants, doctors, lawyers, architects, engineers, the professions, they would create their own professional corporation. So it's to a licensed profession. That's what you would have, a professional corporation. So it would be like Mike Hanahan Architecture, PC. You would often see that PC meaning professional corporation. It was a way to, because of the laws and the complexity of the laws of a corporation, but you really like the protections, they kind of created this entity that kind of worked like a partnership, but had the protections of a corporation. It was quite complex. It wasn't as nimble as you would like to do, but it was to protect professions. Like when an architect gets sued for malpractice, if they were a partnership only, they could go after all the architects and all their houses and their homes. If they were a corporation, there's a lot of problems with double taxations and everything else, so they created this professional kind of a hybrid, but we don't really have it in Illinois anymore. I think there's still a law in the books, but people don't do PCs anymore. And I said each state, how they created professional corporations, they're all different. And the reason why we don't have that is because we have what's called limited liability corporations. So the first place you saw LLCs was in Delaware. They came out and said, we're going to try to clear this all up. Let's try to do the best of both worlds. Let's take this partnership where we have the freedom of partners to be able to do what they want and blah, 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 and have good taxation and be able to make decisions and make profits and hold each other accountable, but not get sued. So we don't have to do that. So we created a limited liability corporation. And for years, people only registered for their companies in Delaware because they were the first ones to come up with this really, I don't know if they were the first ones, but they had the best LLC laws. All states in the country now have LLC laws. This is, you know, going back a couple decades, but started out largely started out in Delaware. It's a separate legal entity. It acts like a corporation. Taxing and accounting, though, are treated like a partnership. No double taxation. That's good. So your $10,000 gets taxed once when you take that money. And it joins the liability protection. So when the LLC gets sued, they can't sue you personally. So it's good like a corporation for being sued and protection. It's also good like a partnership. You only get taxed once. How they do that is like a partnership. You take the money at the end of the year. You can take a draw against that. So they treat it financially as opposed to dividends and things like that. They treat it financially. The business is structured on the money side like a partnership, but the liability side like a corporation. LLCs is governed by state law. There's the Illinois Limited Liability Company Act. So it's there. So everybody makes sure that they're following the rules. It's not really court-created law, like traditional corporations where there's lots and lots of law on how corporations work. You have an operating agreement. Instead of the articles of incorporation for a corporation, for an LLC, you have an operating agreement. But again, you want to have this written document that spells out who are the members and who are the managers and who has money and who has this and that. So you want to have, you need to have actually an operating agreement in Illinois to be an LLC. You fill out a form, and even if you didn't create one, when you fill out the form for the state of Illinois to register the LLC, it has some of the terms and conditions that effectively create your operating agreement. The hierarchy is similar to a corporation. We have members as opposed to shareholders, but they're the owners of the company. Members own the company. We have managers. They're like the officers and directors. You don't have a board of directors in an LLC. You have managers. It could be one. It could be many. And they wear both hats, board of directors and the officers. Those are the people that are the managers, and they are the agents on behalf of the company. And then LLCs can have employees just like a corporation or sole proprietorship or partnership. So it's very, it's much more nimble. It's much more used. It's much, many, much more beneficial. In the construction industry, it's used all the time. So what we have here is a lot of times you will create what's called a single-purpose entity. If I'm going to develop a high-rise on Michigan Avenue, and I'm a developer, Mike Hanahan Development LLC, that's my company, okay? That sits up here. And I'm a manager of it as well as a member. I've got some other members of my company. I have an articles of corporation. I sit up here, and this is my development business. And I develop different projects. So I go and develop this 13-story mid-rise on South Michigan Avenue, like 18th in Michigan. And I put up this, and it's going to be an apartment building. I will create a single-purpose LLC that's called Michigan and 18 LLC. And one of the members of that will be Mike Hanahan LLC. That'll be a member. We'll put some as an entity, it'll be a member, so it's got the money in it. There's going to be individuals that are going to be managers, could be me, could be somebody else. And so when something potentially goes wrong with that deal, the deal goes south, or a wall falls down, or something goes on with the building at Michigan and 18th, they can't and will not sue Mike Hanahan LLC. They'll go after Michigan and 18 LLC. So you create it as a single purpose. And then once the building's done and finished, and I've turned it over to the management company and they're running it, then I terminate the company and the company's gone. It's not the greatest thing, because if something goes wrong with the building, the entity that originally owned it is gone. The people that developed it is gone. Mike, Michigan and 18 is gone. You can't sue anybody now because the people that built it are, because the contracts were between the architect and Michigan and 18 LLC. The contractor was with Michigan and 18 LLC. And now that entity is gone. What do you do? So that's a problem with it, and there's some case law in Illinois. That's a problem with all over the country. There's case law in Illinois that have addressed those things that allow you to go back to the people that kind of jump around that and say, okay, well, you got Hanahan, you got rid of Michigan and 18 LLC, but really the true entity was Mike Hanahan LLC. depending on certain circumstances, you can go back and go after them to make sure. Like, because, you know, if it turns out that all the air conditioners didn't work, which there was a client that I had that they developed a building right off the expressway and they had every single air conditioner didn't work. It leaked and it was ruining people's floors and everything else in the entire unit, the entire place. And the homeowners association went after the LLC that developed it and it was no longer there. And so we were able to get around them to go back. So there's times when you need that. But by and large, the LLC is the best organization. But single purpose for business purposes are great. Sometimes for the recipients, they may be not so great. But it's just a better way to develop things. So questions on that? Yeah?
Sir, was
there an LLC within an LLC? Yes, that was an LLC. Like, one of the members was the LLC. So in like a limited partnership, like you could create yourself as a limited partner when the one of the members could be that. So yes, you can have LLCs that are the members of an LLC. So, but the members can't be gone after because the members are like a shareholder. They're not agents. So I'm not acting on behalf of the company. Only the officers and directors, which are called managers in LLCs, they're the only ones that are acting as agents. So if something goes wrong with Michigan and 18 LLC, the only one you can go after is Michigan 18 or potentially their managers because they're acting as agents. But the members, we're just like a shareholder. Question?
Basically, you're not like as individual that you are liable like your company.
Correct.
So, is that
sort of
an insurance liability?
Yeah. The liability you're going to have here is in contract, where somebody's a breach of contract. If somebody gets injured, you're not going to be able to go after the individuals. You go after the company, the LLC, so you'll go after that. So there is an entity to whom you can file a claim, and hopefully there's funds in the company that which they can pay and recover and so forth and so on. So, and trust me, there's a lot of people that create single-purpose LLCs not to then get rid of them as soon as the project's done. A lot of people don't. They don't do that. It's not as common as you might think. But the protection is to the individual. You're not going to be able to go after your house or your car or whatever. Question?
Would an owner try and not choose someone that's doing that for the case of being involved with the developer?
The answer is probably not, because the LLC is a business operation and entity is so well ingrained in our business structure now that, and like I said, most people are honest. They don't really go and create a single purpose LLC only to run away from them. It has happened, and that's why there's some lawsuits that come down, and they've now, it took a number of years. There was a number of lawsuits where people lost to the homeowners association, and my knowledge is really only in the real estate construction world. I don't know how corporations and businesses and everything else in the more regular traditional transactional world deal with LLCs and these types of things, but in the construction world, I've been in a lot of cases where there's a homeowners association, because they represent the entire building now, suing the LLC, and I've been in situations where the LLC is now worth nothing because it's just pencils and that's about it. I've been in where the LLC still's around and then there's money to collect, and probably more of the latter than the former. So I don't know if an individual would be like, "Oh, I'm not going to enter a contract with you because you're an LLC." I think what would be a good business decision is, "I'm going to enter into a contract with you because you have a good business reputation of developing buildings or whatever it is." So, and then the last thing is the slide here, which goes to your question back there. We have this little check mark. Please mark an X on your slides. There will be a question that you can go to the slide and you'll get the answer right. It won't be this slide, but there'll be a question about what's better and what's worse. So, on your LLCs. So, and that's it. Sorry, we went 11:25, so longer than I expected. But any other questions? Yeah. This chart will not be an exam. There will be a question about LLCs, corporations, sole proprietorships, talking about what is the best for this purpose? Kind of. Go to this slide, I'll probably give you the answer. Kind of. As much as I can give you. So. All right. You guys have a great weekend.